All right, Jeremiah 49. Now we have, as is typical with the majority of the prophets, you have a section that deals with judgment of the surrounding nations, and sometimes not ones that don't border Israel, but invariably have something to do with Israel. And we got down through Edom, if I remember right. We did Moab, Ammon, and Edom, Israel's relations as well as perennial enemies. Seems to go hand in hand, doesn't it, enemies and family? So we've gone through the Ammonites and the Edomites. The next one is Damascus. The city of Damascus is either the oldest or second oldest continually inhabited place on earth. Bounces back and forth with Jericho, depending on what the latest archaeological dig indicates. But both of those places have been inhabited for a long time. They are both oases, and the city of Damascus today has well over 1 million inhabitants, and it is just as Amman, Jordan, because there are springs and rivers that run through that. You remember that Naaman the Syrian was all upset because Elisha said, go dip yourself down seven times in Jordan. He says, are not Abana and Pharpar better rivers than all the rivers of Israel? You have these two rivers coming off of the Lebanon range that gets snow, so it's a snow-fed source. And you got this fast-flowing stream that goes east and out into the desert area, and that's the they come real close to each other, and that's where the city of Damascus is. The folks that have ruled Damascus have been a number of different peoples over the years, and when you read Syrians in your Bible, the term there, and you have a number of these, are Arameans. And Arameans lived in the area, basically the whole area of what is now Syria. And probably the majority of people that live in Syria today have this as their ancestry. You had a number of different tribes and groups and so on, and they lived in the area from roughly the Sea of Galilee all the way up to the Euphrates. And occasionally you would have larger empires that encompass these people. Now, the importance of the Arameans is not any kind of cultural stuff. They didn't leave us an abundance of great monuments and so on. The importance of the Arameans is the language they left behind, which is still spoken by several hundred thousand people, mostly in the country of Syria, a little bit in Lebanon, even today, Aramaic. Portion of the book of Daniel from chapter 2 and verse, I'm going to say 4. Somewhere at the very long beginning, up through chapter 7, is not written in Hebrew, but it's written in Aramaic. There's almost a whole chapter in the book of Ezra that's written in Aramaic. There's one verse in Jeremiah that is written in Aramaic. It uses the same alphabet as Hebrew. It's very close to Hebrew. It's about as different from Hebrew as, say, Italian is from Spanish or something like that. Share a lot of words, but definitely different languages. And these are the folks also that when you read about the time of Elisha, not so much Elijah, but Elisha, you're having this ongoing conflict between the northern kingdom of Israel and the Syrians of Damascus. And they were fighting. We talked about this a little bit last time. Okay, we're going to do my famous map. Okay, and we're going to start up here with the coastline of Turkey, Israel. Okay, and you got the city of Damascus right around here. By the way, in the 67 war, when Israel was fighting against Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, and the Israelis took the Golan Heights, and they went a certain distance, and then they stopped. Not because the war ended, not because the Syrians quit. They stopped about 50 miles from Damascus. And the reason is they could have taken Damascus very easily. They didn't want to have to deal with how in the world are we going to feed 1 million people. And so the Israelis very deliberately stopped short of Damascus, right about here, so that they wouldn't have to deal with that huge population. All right, so Damascus there. Now, I was doing the map for a reason. Okay, this area here, east of the Sea of Galilee, down through here, this is what we talk about. That's the Ammonite territory. Doesn't come up to the Jordan. This is where the tribe of Gad and the tribe of Reuben lived. Then you read about the half tribe of Manasseh. Okay, Manasseh was was up in that area. That region is called, Gilead. Gilead. And Gilead was the reason that you had the Arameans of Damascus, the Syrians, constantly fighting against Israel. They were fighting over that piece of real estate. The main city there was an Israelite city called Jabesh Gilead. And they were constantly fighting back and forth over control of that piece of real estate. You think, why in the world? I mean, you could graze animals there. You could grow some crops there. Why in the world was that piece of ground so important? Because the caravan traffic went through there. And every time a caravan came through, one of the reasons caravan goods were so expensive, not only were they coming so far, but you had to pay a tax every time you went through a new frontier. They would charge a tariff, if you will. That's what we call it today, as you came through their area. So, condemnation of the Syrians of Damascus, beginning in verse 23 of chapter 49. It says, concerning Damascus, Hamath is confounded, Arpad, and they have heard evil tidings. They are faint-hearted. There is sorrow on the sea. It cannot be quieted. Damascus is waxed feeble and turned herself to flee, and fear hath seized on her. Anguish and sorrows have taken her as of a woman in travail. How is the city of praise not left, the city of my joy? Therefore her young men shall fall in her streets. All the young men of war shall be cut off in that day, saith the Lord, and I will kindle a fire in the wall of Damascus, and it shall consume the palaces of Ben-Hadad. And, of course, who is the force that is dealing with the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Edomites and all these different folks that we are reading about? Who is the force that is causing the destruction of these nations and causing the people, their soldiers to die, their capital to be taken, the palaces to be burned, their people carried off into captivity? What is the source of all that in all these cases? Because it's the same in every single one of them. Yeah, Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. He is the force that has come through. Remember, Babylon is way over here, but you have to go up and over. You've got the two rivers, you know, the Tigris and the Euphrates, which at this time never connected. Today they have. But back then they dovetailed, but before they could connect, they dumped into the Persian Gulf. And this is Mesopotamia, which means between the rivers. And so you have this big civilization here, but this is just, like I said, it's serious flat desert. This is the area that our troops had to cross in those truck caravans when we did the invasion of Iraq. And you've seen it's just a big pan of nothing. It's flat, 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 but there's no water either. And so even in ancient times, because it took several days to cross this by caravan, you ran out of water. A camel needs water. 3-4 days tops for a camel. And you couldn't cross this, so they always had to go up and over. And so invasions always came from the north. So Damascus, and then here's where Nebuchadnezzar made his choice. Am I going to go here to Jerusalem, or am I going to go here to Jordan, or to the Ammonites? And at the first choice, he ended up going to Jerusalem. Later on, about 5 years later, he came to Ammon. All right, so destruction of Damascus. The next one, Kedar and Hazor. Kedar and Hazor. As you go through the Bible, you see this mentioned in the Psalms. You see this mentioned just almost in passing. You'll see Kedar mentioned very frequently. Hazor to a lesser extent. There's actually several Hazors. The one they're talking about here, we don't know where it is. Kedar is the one that we hear most of. All right. Where in the world is Kedar? All right. But up is not north. Up is not north. We Westerners always think, okay, let's get my bearings. Okay, there's looking out the window. That's north. And so we have east, we have west, and then south is behind us. In the Middle East, instead of facing north, you face east. And so to the left hand is north, to the right hand is south, and behind you is west. Up is almost always referring to elevation, as opposed to up east or whatever the case may be. We don't think that way. We think differently. And so when it's up, it's talking, that's why it's always up to Jerusalem. It's never down to Jerusalem. It's always up to Jerusalem because of the location and the topography around that, you always had to go uphill to go to Jerusalem. Kedar is this region. I'm sorry, I should have shifted up because I wanted to get the big picture here. Kedar is this region out here. It is east of Moab. It is east of Edom. And what kind of country is that? If you go east of Moab and you go east of Edom, what's it like? It's desert. It's rocky. It's not the flat pan that you have further north. It's rocky. They get a little tiny bit of rain there. It isn't like they don't get any. Now, if you get a little bit of rain, and typically you would get it in late winter, early spring, like they do in California, what do you get as a result of having a little bit of rain and it's seasonal? You always get some vegetation. You get grass. And with the runoff, you get more of it down in the ravines, and it'll last sometimes for months. The folks in Kedar were Arabs. They are descendants of Ishmael, and they raised sheep. And did a little bit of the, they were nomads, and so they're in that area. And Nebuchadnezzar also, they didn't really have much in the way of cities and so on, but they had a lot of wealth in their livestock. And these people also were brought into subjection. And it says that they're look in verse 32, and their camels shall be booty, and their multitude of their cattle a spoil, and I will scatter them to the winds. Them that are in the uttermost corners, and I will bring their calamity upon all sides. So even these folks way out there in the middle of nowhere are going to suffer the ravages of Nebuchadnezzar's invasion. Verse 30, they are told to flee. They are told to take off. Normally you would want to, if you were in this region, the further west you went, the more rainfall you had. But because of the invading army, you're going to want to get as far away as you could possibly survive, because those big armies aren't going to be going out into the wilderness of the desert. They're going to be going over here. And so as Nebuchadnezzar came through Ammon, Moab, and Edom, he looted these people as much as he could as well. Next one, Elam. This one's a little more complicated. Elam is off the map. Elam, okay. If this is Iraq today, this here, Mesopotamia is in Iraq today, what country is over here to the east and a little bit to the north of Iraq? Iran! This is where Iran is. In ancient times, Iran was, up until 1933, Iran was called Persia. It's the same country. All right? And so the border here, this is a big flat area. The only place you have mountains and hills and stuff is way up here in the north, in the Kurdistan area and so on. You get over here, there's a ridge of mountains here called the Taurus Mountains. And that is the border. You climb up into Persia. Persia is a big plateau. And the people who were down here on the lower end of this were the Elamites. They were the Elamites. One of the reasons, now, that's a long way away. What does Elam have to do with Israel? And Elam is mentioned a couple of times in Scripture. What in the world do the Elamites have to do with Israel? Well, for one thing, the Elamites were conquered by the Assyrians a couple of generations before. And when the Assyrians, because Nineveh was up here, they were the folks, when Samaria, the northern kingdom of Israel, was conquered, what did the Assyrians do? They carried tens of thousands of people away captive, and then what did they do? They brought people that they had conquered from other places into Israel. Among the people they brought in were Elamites. So they're mentioned in that accord. And then also, remember, these little nations, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Edomites, these people all hated each other. They would occasionally get together if it was in their best interest. Occasionally they would form a confederacy. They had been working on this to stop Nebuchadnezzar. It didn't pan out real well. They weren't unified enough. The Egyptians didn't fulfill their role as leaders very well in this. But they were working on a confederacy to resist Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had come through earlier and had demonstrated his might, and the people had subjected themselves to him. Why was there suddenly this rebellion? And the reason was, those folks over there in Elam rebelled. And Elam was a big nation. And Nebuchadnezzar's attention was turned east instead of west. And so these folks down here decided, let's take advantage of Nebuchadnezzar's diverted attention. It's looking like if we fight here, he's going to get sandwiched, and it's going to weaken his empire so much the whole thing's going to crumble, and we'll gain our freedom. And so Elam was the catalyst for all the rebellion that took place down here. And in Elam, it didn't work, as we know from history. And Elam was brought into subjection to Nebuchadnezzar. And it talks, and they were noted for their archery. Verse 35, it says, "Behold, I will break the bow of Elam, the chief of their might." And they were subjugated. And but it says in verse 39, the last verse of this chapter, it says, "But it will come to pass in the latter days that I will bring again the captivity of Elam." So here's another nation. Not all these nations that we've looked at, but here's another one of these nations that God has a future for. And it doesn't state in the scripture necessarily why this particular nation is chosen to be one that will be restored in some manner. But they will be. Perhaps because, well, we don't know. I don't know. All right. Any questions on these things that we've looked at here? I'm trying to move a little quicker than we did last time. Any questions on these nations that we've looked at here? Okay. Chapter 50 and chapter 51 are, yes. Only, Hazor and Kedar. And they would be true Arabs, as we understand it today. The true, you know, you have this, the Arabs are, in our thinking, everybody between Iraq and Morocco. But that's a great generalization. They all speak Arabic because of the Quran and because of the Muslim conquest. But as far as true ethnic Arabs, you're only talking about the people who are, in the western side of Saudi Arabia and up to maybe a little bit of southern Jordan. And those are the people that were settled by the descendants of Ishmael. Yeah, the Arabs very much say that we are the descendants of Ishmael. They will say that Ishmael is the son of promise. That Ishmael was the one that Abraham offered on Mount Moriah. They shift everything to gain the preeminence. That the promise is through Ishmael, not through Isaac. All right, Jeremiah chapter 50 and 51 is the longest section in the Bible that is a prophecy against a foreign nation. Now, what's interesting, we'll find out, here at the beginning, let's look at verse 1 of chapter 50. "The word of the Lord that came against Babylon and against the land of the Chaldeans by Jeremiah the prophet." And you don't find out when this prophecy came. And by the way, chapter 51 is the longest chapter in the book. And we've got long chapters in Jeremiah, but chapter 51 is the longest in the book. And you don't get, it isn't until you get toward the end of the chapter that you find out when this took place. Look at verse 59 of chapter 51. Verse 59, chapter 51. "The word which Jeremiah the prophet commanded Sariah, the son of Neriah, the son of Maaseiah, when he went with Zedekiah, king of Babylon, or king of Judah, unto Babylon in the fourth year of his reign." Now, when was Zedekiah blinded and carried off captive to Babylon? 11th year of his reign. Okay, so this is 7 years earlier that Zedekiah made a trip to Babylon. This is the only mention of that trip in the Bible. Why in the world would Zedekiah go to Babylon? Probably to assure Nebuchadnezzar, "I'm faithful, I'm loyal, you know, don't, please don't punish us." The rebellion was going to be a number of years yet, but he probably went there to assure Nebuchadnezzar of his faithfulness. And so this fellow went with Zedekiah on the trip to Babylon. This is 7 years before the fall of Jerusalem. "And Jeremiah wrote in a book all the evil that was going to come upon Babylon, even all these words that are written against Babylon. And Jeremiah said unto Sariah, when thou comest to Babylon and see it, Thou shalt read all these words. So he sent them with a scroll with chapters 51 and 52 in it. Or excuse me, 50 and 51 in it. And he gave him the scroll, and then here's the instructions. When thou comest to Babylon and see it, thou shalt read all these words. Then shalt thou say, O Lord, thou hast spoken against this place to cut it off, that none shall remain in it, neither man nor beast, but that it shall be desolate forever. And it shall come to pass, when thou hast made an end of reading this book, that thou shalt bind a stone to it and cast it into the midst of Euphrates, and thou shalt say, Thus shall Babylon sink and shall not rise from the evil that I will bring upon it, upon her, and they shall be weary, and they shall be weary, and thus far are the words of Jeremiah. Now, up until we get to chapter 50, if you look at everything that Jeremiah has said in regard to Babylon, what has it primarily been dealing with? What's he been saying about Babylon? He hasn't said it's been evil. What's that? Okay, Nebuchadnezzar in particular, Babylon as a whole, is a tool. He's saying that Nebuchadnezzar is God's servant. Why is he God's servant? To bring about God's justice. He is the executioner of God's justice, Nebuchadnezzar is. Not because Nebuchadnezzar is good and great, and by the way, if you want to wrestle these things out, that's what the book of Habakkuk is all about. Habakkuk is looking around. He was probably around at the beginning of Jeremiah's ministry. Habakkuk is looking around and he's seeing how wicked Jerusalem is. And he's pleading to God, saying, God, how can you tolerate this? How can you tolerate the wickedness that's going on here in Judah and Jerusalem? And so God answers and said, okay, I'm going to send Nebuchadnezzar, and he's going to bring justice. And Habakkuk says, how can you use Nebuchadnezzar? He's worse than we are. And he says, well, then I'll deal with Nebuchadnezzar afterward. And then the end of Habakkuk is Habakkuk's just saying, God, you're in charge, and I'll submit to that. That's basically what it's about. All right, so you get a resolution to that question there. So one of the things that Jeremiah's opposition had been accusing him of is being an acolyte of Babylon. Oh, you love Babylon. You're a Babylon lover. You support Babylon more than you support your own nation. You love Babylon more than you love Jerusalem. You're a lackey for Nebuchadnezzar. And yet here we have 7 years before the fall of the city, 5.5 years before Nebuchadnezzar comes for the siege, and you have this long prophecy condemning, in no uncertain words, Babylon. You read Jeremiah, and we know from things we've seen earlier in the book of Jeremiah loved his people. Jeremiah loved his nation. And this makes it clear that he was no fan of Babylon. He was simply telling the people what God had told him to say, and that Nebuchadnezzar was a tool in God's hand to accomplish God's justice. Not because Nebuchadnezzar was so great, but simply because Nebuchadnezzar was the tool that God chose to use to bring about his justice in regard to these nations. Understand, this is the same thing that we wrestle with when we look at Joshua and the annihilation of the Canaanites. Oh, that's awful. Oh, that's terrible. When we have a great crime committed in our land and some guy gets caught, boy, I'm so glad they caught. I hope he gets his. I hope this fellow gets justice. This guy murdered this person and this person. They pleaded with him and he killed him anyway, and they caught him and they have the evidence there, and he's going to be convicted, and I hope they put him away or execute him. That's what needs to happen. That's justice. What do you do when you have a nation that's that wicked? A people that has been, for example, sacrificing their children, burning their children alive by the thousands every year, who invade their neighbors and rip up the women that are pregnant so that the nation is not able to perpetuate itself. How do you deal with a nation that does that kind of thing? Because they're an independent nation. Maybe they're stronger than you are. How does God, because God is just, how does God bring about justice? Well, in this case, he's using this big guy over here who has an empire that's in this area here, and he's going to use this guy as his tool of justice on all these little wicked nations over here. Now, does that mean Nebuchadnezzar is good? No. Because eventually this nation will get theirs. Because they not only did what God wanted them to do, but they went way overboard as well. Their cruelties and everything else far exceeded what God had required of them, which is an indication of their own wickedness. So, back to, and we're going to do a survey here rather than dealing with all the details here. Because there's a couple of things that are very interesting about this. Now, let me get you your notes. Here's chapters, this is the rest of the book. And there's some interesting things about this because Jeremiah is going to make some prophecies that haven't come to pass yet. And so we'll do a little bit of discussing about how in the world this is all going to come about. Here's an extra one for Sue. Okay, everybody got one? Everybody got one? What did I give you? My sermon notes from this morning?
Probably.
Yeah, I did. Okay, what do you need? There you go. Anybody else get my sermon notes from this morning? They don't have holes in them. Everybody got holes in the edge of their paper? You got a copy of my sermon notes? Okay, he got page one. All right. Everybody else, we're good? Better count the pages I got here. One, two, three, okay. All right. Concerning Babylon. What you have, and like I said, I'm just going to do a survey of this. Babylon is, the city is basically square. It has a 22-mile perimeter. It's that big. On the walls. The walls have a 22-mile perimeter. This doesn't include the farms and the burbs that spread out from there. It's a huge city. It straddles the Euphrates. Ancient Greek historians said that the walls were so thick, they were over 200 feet high, they were shaped like this. They had to be because they're made out of baked mud bricks, okay? Actually, a little bit more like that, the steeper side on the outside. Otherwise, you might be able to get some guys with sticky fingers that can climb up the outside. And they were so wide that you could run four chariots abreast on the top, so says Greek historian. They were that thick. So over 200 feet high and that thick. You have a 22-mile perimeter. They've got water because it straddles the Euphrates. Now, when you have the handwriting on the wall in Daniel, it's talking about that's the night of the fall of Babylon. How does a city that big, how do defenses that impregnable, how does a city like that fall? And it wasn't due to an earthquake. Okay. Remember, the Euphrates ran under the city walls. They had these gigantic bronze pillars every once in a while holding up the wall and the river running underneath it. And what Cyrus the Persian did is he built a huge canal a couple miles away. Had his men working on that. They got slave labor from all the peoples that they had conquered. And they built this huge canal and created a new bed for the Euphrates. And then after dark, they broke down the dam, rerouted the river, and during the night, walked under the walls of the city and came into the city of Babylon. The city was so big that it was taken and in the hands of the Persians before half the people inside the walls knew what had happened. They had secured the palaces, they had taken over the defenses, and the people on the interior of this gigantic square of a city were clueless as to what had happened. They had no idea. Now, that's how it was done. Let's look at some of the things that are said about the city. Now, we already looked at what we see at the end of chapter 51. It says it'll be uninhabited, it'll be desolate, no one will live there. You have mingled throughout this, you have comments about Israel's restoration, Israel's return to their land, the year that Babylon was taken by the Persians is the same year that Cyrus made his declaration that the children of Israel could return to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple. Same year. Maybe in the same week or the same day. But that's what happened. Now remember, by and large, the Jews were not living within the city. They were in one of the burbs up to the north. You read about the river Kibar, which is one of the canals off of the Euphrates. That's where the Jews lived. They lived north of Jerusalem. They weren't in the siege of the city. And so you have this constant mention of Israel's return. You have at least two warnings for the Jews to leave Babylon before the destruction takes place. You have toward the end of chapter 50 the fact that their destruction is permanent. You have the nations summoned in chapter 51 to wreak their vengeance on Babylon. And the completeness of the fall and of its destruction. Now, when the Persians took the city in, I'm trying to remember the date, 530-something or other B.C., what did they do? They came under the walls. They conquered they took control of the city. What'd they do? When you read Daniel, and you have the situation, remember the lion's den. Who was the king when Daniel was thrown in the lion's den? A fellow named Darius. Darius is a Mede, which means he's an ally of the Persians. So it's under Persian control when you have the whole lion's den scenario. Babylon is intact. Not only is Babylon intact, but it is so much intact that the conquering king, Darius was an underling king, a client king of Cyrus, that when they took control, they used a lot of the same politicians. They used the same administration that had served under the Babylonians. Daniel is part of the government under the Persians as he had been under the Babylonians. You still have a huge city. You have Darius living in the palace. The palace wasn't burned. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons that the city was taken is that the priests of Marduk, of Bel, Marduk and Bel is different names for the same god, were actually party to the Persians taking over because they had a vendetta against the then king of Babylon. So all you had was a change in administration. Now granted, you had the problem that the river is now a couple miles away, but other than that, nothing has changed. The people are still there. The city is intact. The worship of Bel is still in place. They are still using the same politicians to run the place. And yet we see in this prophecy and a number of other prophecies in your Old Testament dealing with Babylon, we see mentions of total destruction and that no one lives there. And that the destruction is permanent. So what happened to ancient Babylon? By the way, you can go online, just type in ancient Babylon or ruins of Babylon. You got all kinds of pictures. They've excavated huge portions of this city. When Aaron and I were in New York City a little over 3 years ago, we went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and they had the glazed brick panels from the Ishtar Gate, the main gate of Babylon, that were dug up by the Germans back in the teens or the 20s. And they are now on permanent loan at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. And you go through and it's got these glazed panels, profiles of lions and dragons. And these are the exact same panels that Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar walked past as they went in and out of that city. Which was kind of cool to see that. Yeah, I'm looking at what Daniel looked at. I'm looking at what Nebuchadnezzar looked at. So you had this happen, but Babylon was still standing. Babylon was the city where Alexander the Great died over 200 years after Jeremiah. Babylon was still standing and still occupied, and people were still living there at the time of Christ. Now, the population was going down, and the reason the population was going down is because the river wasn't right there. But the city was still there. It's kind of like going to Flint, Michigan, or Gary, Indiana. You know, it's still there. Not as many people live there, and it's not in as good shape as it used to be. But it's still there, and people still live there. I've been to both of those places. They're almost the ruins of America. Detroit. So, what happened to Babylon? No one lives there today. And it had to do with the fact the population kept going down and down and down. And finally, it was just too big and too few people. And the people that were left there finally just, they left and they went to Baghdad, which was now the rising thing, and it wasn't that far away. And so it was abandoned. It was not destroyed. It was abandoned. You did not have massive slaughter when the Persians took over. Probably several hundred people died, but not the destruction of a nation with tens of thousands or even millions of people being slaughtered and those being enslaved and the city being looted. It was not. It was left in place. So when Jeremiah and some of these others are talking about the annihilation and the destruction of the city, they're talking about something else. They have to be. Or they're talking about something future. Because what they have declared has not happened. So either they're talking about something else, but they use Babylon. They use Babylon. Or they're talking about an event that has yet to happen. Yes?
A co-worker's done four deployments to Iraq, and he says he's been to Babylon a couple of times. They have grandiose entrance into their city.
Yeah, they've rebuilt the Ishtar Gate. If you can go back and visit the ruins, they've rebuilt the Ishtar Gate. It's sort of like a tourist thing. That is Babylon. That is the same Babylon that Jeremiah's talking about. It's the same city. You can go visit, but no one lives there. It's a tourist attraction. It's an excavation site. No one lives there. You might have a couple of shacks or something where the workers live, but, you know, it's not a city. Saddam Hussein wanted to rebuild Babylon. He had plans to do that. He wanted to rebuild Babylon. He pictured himself as the new Nebuchadnezzar IV or the third. That he was going to be the new Nebuchadnezzar. Of course, we know it didn't pan out. Okay. If you look at it, it's a great location on a worldwide basis. You've got more water than you have any place else in that whole area of the world. You're sitting on a giant pool of oil. So you've got water. You've got oil. You're at the crossroads of Asia, Europe, and Africa, or very close to there. You have access to the Persian Gulf to get your stuff out into the Indian Ocean. You could, if the political situation was right, you could run highway and rail lines to the Mediterranean. It's not that far. It's a great location. If you had peace and unity in that part of the world, it makes all kinds of sense to build a new Babylon. Now, if you get a new commentary on Revelation, something that's been written in the last 15, 20 years, if you get a new commentary on Revelation that is from a premillennial position that believes that basically everything in Revelation from chapter 4 on is future, the dominant view is that the Babylon in the book of Revelation is Babylon. Now, if you were to get a commentary that's 30 or 40 years old or older, Babylon is never Babylon. Babylon instead is Rome. Which is it? We don't know. I'm more inclined to think that there will be a Babylon future. And one of the reasons I'm in is not necessarily the same thing that Revelation is talking about. But just looking at your Old Testament prophecies, I'm very strongly inclined to think that there will be a Babylon in the future. And one of the reasons is, you go through what Jeremiah has written regarding Moab and Ammon and Edom and Kedar and Hazor and Damascus and Elam and all and Egypt and all these other peoples that he wrote about, and he goes down in the detail, and yes, this happened, down to the minutest detail. He's talking about literal nations. This actually happened. And then we come to Babylon. Is he going to suddenly shift gears and talk about, is using figurative language to talk about a nation that doesn't exist yet? I don't think so. It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit. You don't typically shift metaphors in the same passage in Scripture. Sometimes you'll shift metaphors, but not in the same passage. Not usually. Not in any one that I can think of. So I believe that he's talking about a literal Babylon. It doesn't necessarily have to occupy the exact same site. They may change the name of Baghdad to Babylon. And I've voiced my opinion in the past, I don't know if I've done it recently, that I believe that during the tribulation, right at the beginning of the tribulation, perhaps even before the tribulation starts, that you will have the vanquishing of Islam. Islam will be conquered and destroyed. And the reason I believe that is because by the midpoint of the tribulation, Israel has their temple. Why don't the Jews have their temple now? In 1967, what's his name? The Israeli general with the eye patch. Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan, they took the West Bank. They took the old city. And there were a number of the Jews that said, now we can have our temple. After 2,000 years, we can now rebuild our temple. And Moshe Dayan said, no. We have barely survived fighting Egypt, Syria, and Damascus. And if we go to the Temple Mount and knock down the Dome of the Rock, we will have to deal with all of Islam. And we cannot survive. And so they turned the Temple Mount over to the administration of the Jordanians. It's still ruled, dominated by, the Israelis can go in there and take it. But you walk to the Temple Mount today and you see the young men in their fatigues carrying machine guns. Those are not Israelis on the Temple Mount. The Jordanian. The reason they don't have a temple is because of Islam. You have to vanquish Islam in order to get a temple. And so I believe that you're going to have, and if you vanquish Islam, if there's a war that wipes out Mecca and Medina, they take that big black rock and turn it into powder and dump it in the Pacific Ocean, it doesn't exist anymore, you cannot fulfill one of the tenets of Islam. They will have to change their religion or stop their religion. You cannot practice Islam if you destroy that rock. And I believe that something's going to happen to vanquish Islam to allow the rebuilding of the temple. If you vanquish Islam and the people get it that it's been vanquished because they can't fulfill their pilgrimage, you may end up with at least a facade of peace in that region, and you may turn it into an industrial commercial center because it's got the water and it's got the oil and it's the crossroads of the world. So you may end up with the rebuilding of Babylon. Cities can be built in short order. Randy, you in here.
Are they excavating?
They're not supposed to be. If they are, I don't know about it. Hezekiah's water tunnel has been closed for years. They used to allow tourists to go underneath there, but they don't allow it anymore because the Palestinians and Jordan, the Muslim authorities were afraid that the Israeli terrorists were going to dynamite it from below, the Dome of the Rock. My personal view, I've already shared this, my opinion is that the bronze altar, the brazen altar, the Ark of the Covenant, the candelabra, the showbread tables, and the altar of incense are all buried on the Temple Mount. On the mount. And the reason I believe that... Pardon me? They couldn't. The Babylonians were outside the city. Because here at chapter 51, if you look at... or chapter 52. Go to chapter 52. Look at verse 17. chapter 52, beginning at verse 17. Also the pillars of brass, which were in the house of the Lord, those great big columns that were outside the temple, and the bases and the brazen sea that were in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans brake and carried all the brass of them to Babylon. The cauldrons also, and the shovels, and the snuffers, and the bowls, and the spoons, and all the vessels of brass wherewith they ministered took they away, and the basins, and the firepans, and the bowls, and the cauldrons, and the candlesticks, and the spoons, and the cups that were of gold, that was of gold, and that which was of silver and silver took the captain of the guard away. The two pillars, the one sea, the 12 brazen bulls that were under the bases which King Solomon had made for the house of the Lord, the brass of all these vessels was without weight. And concerning the pillars, the height of one pillar was 18 cubits. And a fillet of 12 cubits did compass it, and the thickness thereof was 4 fingers, it was hollow. And the chapter of brass that was upon it, and the height of one chapter was 5 cubits, with the network and the pomegranates upon the chapter round about, all of brass. The second pillar also, and the pomegranates were like unto these. There were 96 pomegranates on a side, and all the pomegranates and all the network were 100 round about. Period. That's the stuff they carried away. There is never any mention anywhere in the Bible of the things that I just mentioned, the brazen altar, the Ark of the Covenant, the table of showbread, the altar of incense, and the candelabra. Those things being taken away, but not mentioned anywhere. I believe, my personal view is that Solomon, I think, did this, built vaults down into the ground, 20, 30 feet down, and they had ledges on them so you could lower a stone and then lower another stone and lower another stone in on top of it, so they are down in vaults down below. All the people that knew about this were killed. The high priests and all his people were killed at the destruction of Jerusalem. All the people that know where this is were killed. They came back, they got the temple fixings, all the shovels and all this other stuff, all the small stuff, because the big stuff had all been broken to pieces and destroyed. But all the small stuff was sent back with Zerubbabel when they went back to Jerusalem. But where are those 5 pieces? And a lot of people, our tour guide when we were in Jerusalem, thought that they were buried there. And this is one of the reasons why they will not allow echolocation equipment on the Temple Mount. The Arabs will not allow that up there because they're afraid they're going to find something. So that's for what it's worth. Chapter 52, very quickly. You have a restating. It's mentioned in chapter 39 as well, a restating of the fall of Jerusalem. The siege mentioned in verses 4 and 5, the famine in verse 6. And then it says there in verse 7, and the city was broken up, and the men of war fled, and went forth out of the city by night by the way of the gate between the two walls, which was by the king's garden. And the Chaldeans were all about the city, and they went down by the way of the plain. They headed to Jericho. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued after the king and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. If he had made it across Jordan, he probably would have gotten away. He was heading for Ammon. And all his army were scattered from him. Then they brought him before the king and carried him up before the king of Babylon at Riblah in the land of Hamath, and he passed judgment on him. They blinded him and so on, and they carried him off to Babylon. And it says there in verse 12, we have the destruction of the city, the looting of the treasures that we've already looked at, verses 17 through 23. The people who were in charge, the priesthood, a lot of the false prophets, the administration under Zedekiah, the military commanders were brought from Jerusalem up to where Nebuchadnezzar was, because he wasn't actually at the site. He was up in a place called Hamath, some distance to the north. They were brought all the way up in Syria. They were brought all the way up there. Nebuchadnezzar passed judgment, had them all executed before his face. Here's the captives, starting in verse 20, second half of verse 27. And the king of Babylon smote and put them to death in Riblah. Okay, we talked about that before in Hamath, in the land of Hamath. Then Judah was carried away captive out of his own land. This is the people that Nebuchadnezzar carried away captive. In the 7th year, okay, the first time you had a deportation, 3,000 Jews, 320. All right, so 3,023 people were carried away captive. This is when Daniel was carried away captive. And then it says, in verse 29, in the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar, he carried again a captive from Jerusalem, 832 people. And that would be in 597 BC. That would be when Ezekiel was carried away captive. And then you had the final one when the city was destroyed in 586 BC. And it says in verse 30, in the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, carried away captive of the Jews, 745 people. All told, it was 4,600 people. Now, if you read other places in the Bible, you'll find a discrepancy in the numbers. This is a smaller number than the other ones. What accounts for the discrepancy? By the way, those who don't believe the Bible say, see, we got a problem here. It's not a problem. What's the cause for the discrepancy? Very simple. Very often, what are they counting? When Jesus fed the multitudes, he said he fed this many men besides women and children. So when you have the larger number, you are including others besides the men. And we know that the women went because Ezekiel had a wife with him in Babylon. So all told, 4,600 men at least were carried away captive. So that's the end of it. But we have a little spot of good news here at the end, verse 31. And it came to pass in the 37th year. It's a long time later. A couple decades have passed. Of the captivity of Jehoiakim, C-H-I-N. Now, who was the last king there in Jerusalem? A fellow by the name of Zedekiah. Zedekiah is Jehoiakim's uncle. Zedekiah is rotting in prison in Babylon, having been blinded. Jehoiakim was the 18-year-old kid that went out with his mother and gave up when Nebuchadnezzar showed up and was carried away captive. And he was in prison. He was 18 when he was carried away. He's been in prison for that long. 37 years go by. In the 12th month, in the 25th day of the month, evil Merodach, also known as Amon-Marduk, who was Nebuchadnezzar's biological son, who succeeded Nebuchadnezzar. Evil Merodach, king of Babylon, in the first year of his reign, lifted up the head of Jehoiakim. By the way, that lifting up the head is the same phrase that was used for lifting up Joseph's head when he was in prison in Egypt. Lifted up the head of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and brought him forth out of prison, and spake kindly unto him, and set his throne above the throne of the kings that were with him in Babylon, and changed his prison garments, and he did eat bread continually eat bread before him all the days of his life. And by the way, they have actually found documents in the excavation of Babylon that talk about this. So you have this guy who was taken out of prison. He is made from a prisoner, a respected and honored prison. I mean, he was probably not languishing terribly, but he's still in prison. And now he's made a prince. This guy was now free, and he now has wife or wives and has children. The line of Christ in Matthew chapter 1 is through this guy. It was necessary to fulfill the Davidic covenant that he be released from prison in order that the line would continue. And that's how the book ends. It's open-ended on two things. Babylon has yet to be, and the Davidic line continues. All right, any questions at all on what we've looked at through here? A lot of stuff here. This is 35 weeks doing Jeremiah. Yes? Oh, where Syria is here. Okay, you've got a row of mountains. Here, high mountains. Mount Hermon is part of this. Okay, high mountains. Okay, you've got fast-flowing rivers that come off of these mountains. They're fed by the winter snows that come down. There's two rivers here, Abana and Pharpar. That's with PH, firepower. And that's what gives Damascus its water. These are the mountains of Lebanon. And you have these rivers flowing east into the desert. And it's kind of like we were in Wenatchee and Leavenworth. You have this river flowing off of these mountains, but going east. And if you didn't have the Columbia, it would just sort of wander around in the desert and eventually sort of disappear, dump out into a lake. You'd have a salt lake. What's that?
What was the other river?
Pharpar and Abana. Just like it's A-B-A-N-A. Like banana. No. But although they were very careful to preserve Babylon, they did not destroy anything that they didn't have to. They were very careful. Cyrus was very interested. He was an oddball for an ancient ruler. When he conquered a people, he messed up things as little as possible. If the people would capitulate, he left them as is, even gave them a lot of latitude as far as how they ruled their own affairs. As long as they paid taxes and didn't rebel, he was fine with it. This is why he allowed the Jews to go back and rebuild Jerusalem and their temple. The Persians generally had this policy, and Cyrus in particular. A lot of local rule, allowing the people to rule over themselves. As long as they didn't rebel, as long as they paid taxes, he didn't care what they did. A lot of latitude with that. Whereas most people would come in and just say, we'll show you how powerful I am, and we'll pulverize everything. And one of the drawbacks with that is if you wipe everything out, these people aren't able to make a living to pay your taxes. Cyrus knew, if I leave Babylon as an industrial and commercial center, I'll get a lot of loot out of this. Instead of getting it all at once, they will be able to continue to make a living and pay taxes. It's a much better deal to operate that way. Although he was one of the first ones to realize it. All right, anything else? Okay, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. Father, as we have finished up Jeremiah here, thank you for a man who was faithful in spite of all the odds, who had humanly every reason to quit. And yet, Father, he was faithful to the end. And Father, I pray that you'd give us the same vision, that our support, our strength, our source of power, and our true allegiance is to you and, frankly, to you alone. And Father, we get pulled in all different kinds of directions. Father, may our loyalty and our faithfulness be to you. And Father, we know that you will see us through. You will give us the strength to do what is right. It's not always pleasant. It's not always easy. Jeremiah suffered terribly off and on throughout this time. And yet, Father, you gave him the strength to do what was right. May we be faithful. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen. Well, remember, he had a couple of folks that were, you had Barak, his friend Barak. There were several other princes that were supportive. The fellow who ended up getting murdered, but Gedaliah was evidently a supporter of Jeremiah. He had a few, which is one of the ways that God kept him alive, was to use some of the supporters that he had.